Today is Tuesday, April 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
It's really not clear, because up until Netanyahu made that announcement last week, the official Likud position was that Israel would withdraw from at least part of the West Bank in exchange for a peace deal with the Palestinians.
Israelis vote today in parliamentary elections with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decade-long hold on powers at stake. Also ahead, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls on all parties in Libya to immediately engage in dialogue to reach a political resolution to end the conflict. It's all on today's International Edition. Israelis are voting today in parliamentary elections with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decade-long hold on power at stake as he faces a tough contest with former military chief Benny Gantz. Ahead of the voting, polls indicated Netanyahu's Likud party and Gantz's blue and white winning a similar number of seats in the 120-member Knesset. If that occurs, the 69-year-old Netanyahu might win a fifth term in a coalition with smaller right-wing parties allied to him. As the months-long campaign neared an end, Netanyahu reminded voters of his close relationship with U.S. President Donald Trump. He thanked the U.S. leader for responding yesterday to a request to designate Iran's Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization. The 59-year-old Gantz said he favors a globally backed peace agreement that envisions Israel maintaining its hold on the large settlement blocks in the West Bank and security control over the territory. Associated Press reporter Charles de Ledesma has more.
Clouded by a series of looming corruption indictments, Netanyahu is seeking a fourth consecutive and a fifth overall term in office, which would make him Israel's longest ever serving leader, surpassing even founding father David Ben-Gurion. But he faces a stiff challenge from retired military chief Benny Gantz, whose blue and white party has inched ahead in Netanyahu's Likud in polls. Official results will begin streaming in early Wednesday, but it may take far longer for a final verdict to come through given the fragmented state of Israeli politics. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Well, opinion studies show Netanyahu and Gantz with about equal public support. That might mean that Netanyahu, with the support of allied conservative parties, could gain enough support in the 120-member Knesset to remain Israel's leader. Netanyahu recently made news by promising to annex some areas of the West Bank, currently occupied by Israelis. Palestinians also have claims on the West Bank. VOA's Mario Ritter Jr. asked reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the U.S. recognition of Israel's claim to the Golan Heights area and Netanyahu's goal of annexing additional territory in the West Bank. She said the issues are seen differently by Israelis.
The West Bank is a different issue. It's really not clear, because up until Netanyahu made that announcement last week, the official Likud position was that Israel would withdraw from at least part of the West Bank in exchange for a peace deal with the Palestinians. And it's not clear what exactly he means, what areas he would want to annex. And I think it has more to do with trying to court right-wing votes than it has to do with a real change of policy. That said, one of the parties on the right, called the New Right Party, has called to annex the 60% of the West Bank where the Jewish settlements are built. There are about 400,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank who live alongside 2.6 million Palestinians. And to annex those parts of the West Bank, the 60% where the Jewish settlers live, if that was done, it would really, I think, cause a huge international outcry and would lead to a boycott of Israel and a tremendous amount of anger in the international community. So there's a clear difference between the way most Israelis look at the Golan Heights and how they look at the West Bank.
Is it fair to say this election is a referendum on the more internationalist Gantz and Netanyahu being more conservative?
Well, I think it's definitely a referendum on Netanyahu. And Netanyahu has been in office for 13 years straight. And in addition, he had another term at the end of the 90s. If he wins, he is set to become the longest-serving Israeli prime minister in July. Netanyahu is definitely hardline, conservative, a security hawk. At the same time, Gantz, he's a former chief of staff. He has no political experience. And we don't really know what his political attitudes are. I mean, they seem to be more centrist, but we really don't know yet exactly what he thinks on some of the issues. So it's really a referendum on, do people want another term with Netanyahu following 13 years or not? There definitely is growing frustration, I think, with Netanyahu. He is facing a series of corruption allegations. The attorney general has said that he should be indicted. He will then, after some point after the election, there will be a hearing and then a final decision made sometime in the next year. And if he's indicted, it's most likely that he will have to step down. So I think there is kind of a lot of frustration with Netanyahu, but there's also some hesitancy about Gantz at the same time.
What are the public opinion studies, and what is the opinion that you're seeing today as people are voting?
Well, so far, it's a little bit hard to know, and polls have been wrong in the past. Israel is a parliamentary democracy, so you don't vote for the person, you vote for a party. And then the party with the largest number of seats is charged by the Israeli president with forming a coalition. When you look at the coalition blocks, the right wing, headed by the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has a clear advantage over the center and the left wing, headed by Benny Gantz.
What will you be looking at most closely in the results?
Right. I think, again, what's going to be the most interesting is how the blocks fall out. It's very complicated here because to get into the Knesset, you need to have a minimum of 3.25%, which is equivalent to four seats in the 120-seat Knesset. So if a party gets less than that 3.25%, it means that those votes are essentially wasted. So everything could change if any of the smaller parties, and there are several on the right that are sort of floating right around this 3.25%, the minimum in order to get in. So if they don't get in, that could kind of change the entire situation. So what I'll be looking at most closely is the blocks.
That was Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem speaking with VOA's Mario Ritter, Jr. While the UN Secretary General is calling on all parties in Libya to immediately engage in dialogue to reach a political resolution to the Libyan conflict, declaring that there is no military solution, the U.S. called on General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the self-proclaimed National Libyan Army, to stop his military push toward Tripoli. It appeared the U.N. will postpone a national conference that was set to begin Sunday to pave the way for elections. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London consulting firm Libya Analysis, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the possible scenarios in Libya and whether international calls to end the fighting would be enough to end Haftar's military campaign.
The UN doesn't really have much influence in Libya. Haftar actually launched his campaign while the UN Secretary General was in the country. The international statements, some of them, as you say, have singled out Haftar. Others have stuck to this sort of more broad, all parties must cease their military actions. And this reflects the reality that Haftar does still have a lot of support among some of the key nations internationally, but also the other drivers of his move on Tripoli. It's not purely international legitimacy. He's also got his own supporters in country to answer to. If he's to withdraw now, that will go against this narrative of military domination and kind of liberation that he's painted. Equally, if he withdraws now, he could lose that momentum. He may not be able to access some of the power that he thought he would be able to have. Haftar may well be betting on the fact that if he can gain control of Tripoli militarily, even though the UN and others are saying that's not acceptable, if he's there and on the ground, then they will have to listen to him and people will have to strike political deals with him.
What are the possible scenarios in Libya?
But I would say there's probably three or four very big picture scenarios. First is that Haftar and his forces are able to militarily take control of Tripoli. I think that's very unlikely at the moment. They don't have the support from within Tripoli. They don't have the military capacity and they don't have the kind of supply lines going back to eastern Libya to be able to sustain that kind of offensive into the center of the city. The second is that the kind of anti-Haftar GNA line forces are able to completely drive the LNA forces out of the city by undermining their supply lines. This is possible. It won't happen straight away, but it is more possible in the longer run. But that still isn't a good scenario for Libya. That means that the militias will be further empowered, and it makes it less likely that any kind of political solution will be able to reach because of that. The third is a kind of protracted stalemate in some ways, where there's really kind of escalating or continued conflict in and around Tripoli, which will have a deteriorating effect on the whole country and could lead to wider escalation in the whole country, really. And I suppose the fourth, and well, the one that we would hope will happen but doesn't seem very likely at the moment, is that there will be some kind of negotiated political solution that will lead both parties to stand down.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Well, Libya is likely to be among the items on the agenda today as U.S. President Donald Trump meets with Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi at the White House today. A senior administration official said topics under discussion include tensions in the Middle East, security, economic reform, and human rights in Egypt. The U.S. official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the two leaders would also discuss the development of civil society in Egypt. Egypt's parliament has moved toward constitutional amendments that could allow Sisi to stay in power until 2034. Michelle Dunn, director of Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi about how Egyptian voters see the amendments and the tension between the administration and U.S. Congress over how to deal with President el-Sisi.
What Egyptian citizens are saying right now is not much, and it's also hard to know what they're thinking because the traditional media has been largely taken over by state-owned or state-financed companies. There really is no longer a viable, independently owned media in Egypt, which is very sad because they had it for a while. And so it's hard to know what they think. What is probably the most likely scenario is that when these constitutional amendments are put to a popular referendum, that many people will try to stay home and stay quiet. The state will try to bus employees of public sector companies and so forth to the polling places to vote for the referendum. There has been some discussion, talk on social media and so forth of Egyptians going out to vote no for the referendum or protesting in some other ways, wearing black on the day of the referendum. We don't know right now whether any of that will really materialize, but it would take a great deal of courage because the price of expressing any opposition in Egypt now is extremely high.
But would the Congress put any linkage between the military aid to Egypt and human rights and the rule of law?
I expect that there will be criticism from significant, important members of the U.S. Congress of these constitutional amendments. There is conditionality written into the legislation regarding U.S. military assistance to Egypt. A portion, almost a quarter, of that military assistance is subject to conditions related to human rights and democracy. That's going to continue to be an issue, and I think we're going to continue to see a bit of a struggle between the Congress and the administration. The Congress wanting to uphold the traditional role of the United States in championing human rights and democracy around the world and wanting to make some cuts to assistance to Egypt, or at least withhold some assistance from Egypt in order to make a point, and the administration not wanting to do that, partly because I think the administration has in mind a role for Egypt in the planned Trump-Israel
deal
peace plan
century.
Or deal of the century. Yeah. That could be one reason why they would want to keep relations with Sisi friendly and without tension.
That was Michelle Dunn, director of Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Among the top stories in the world, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani denounces the United States as the actual head of global terrorism, one day after the U.S. designated Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. The architects of Hong Kong's 2014 democracy protest, known as the Umbrella Movement, were found guilty today of public nuisance charges in a verdict that has been criticized by political leaders and rights groups. And former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn blames his legal woes on a conspiracy hatched by executives who feared losing their own influence in the company. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. app. This is VOA's International Edition. Hardline Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini and members of nationalist parties from around Europe met yesterday in Milan to discuss forming a broad international alliance within the European Parliament. Their talks come as the European Union prepares for May 26 elections aimed at choosing members of the Parliament. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
At the gathering in a Milan luxury hotel, the nationalist and anti-immigrant forces said they want to create a major new grouping to shake up the European Union following elections next month. Matteo Salvini, who also serves as Italy's interior minister, organized the meeting held under the slogan "Toward a Common Sense Europe." Joining him were Jörg Merten, chairman of the Alternative for Germany party, Olli Kotro of the Finns Party and Anders Vistisen of the right-wing Danish People's Party. Germany's Meuthen said the planned bloc would comprise at least 10 nationalist parties from different EU member states. Far-right populists in power in a number of European nations, including Italy, Austria, Poland and Hungary, are expected to do well in the May 26th elections. Salvini has pledged to bring about a new European spring. He says they are working for a new European dream. Salvini was clear about his plans as he addressed the news media. He says the ambitious objective of those present is to create the leading group of the next European Parliament, the largest, most important, most decisive, and most addressed to the future. He added they will have the newest ideas and hope to be present in nearly all of the European countries that will be voting. Salvini says he does not do something with an eye to losing or simply to participate, but that the objective would be to win and change the rules of Europe. He says many others will be joining the group and that plans are underway to hold a large gathering for the new Europe in Milan's Piazza Duomo, May 18th. Salvini says that what they have in mind is a new Europe that looks toward the future and to the coming generations. Although there were notable absentees like Marine Le Pen of France's nationalist rally and Austrian far-right politician Heinz Christian Strache, Salvini appeared confident that his planned large international bloc of nationalists would be created. Most share common views over immigration and the desire for certain powers to be returned to the member states' capitals, but not all of them agree on economic and social policies. Observers have voiced fear that far-right groups are no longer on the fringes politically and are becoming more mainstream. Salvini also addressed the issue of Turkey, which is seeking to join the EU. Salvini said talks with Turkey, which have been suspended, should be cancelled. Salvini has said he believes Turkey would be an Islamic influence that is not needed in Europe and that the country is too different culturally. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr today declined to discuss with lawmakers any specifics of special counsel Robert Mueller's report on the Russia investigation, but said he expects to issue a redacted version of the document within a week. Testifying on Capitol Hill for the first time since issuing a summary of the special counsel's findings, Barr faced intense criticism from Democrats, who suggested the attorney general had acted to shield President Donald Trump from the full weight of the probe's conclusions. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Well, venom from a dangerous spider could give stroke patients a better chance of survival, according to Australian biochemists. They have found that a neurotoxin secreted by the Fraser Island funnel web spider contains a molecule that stalls the effects of stroke has on the brain. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A bite from the Fraser Island funnel web spider can kill a person in 15 minutes, but its venom could be life-saving and used to develop a drug to prevent brain damage. Scientists say the toxins can shut off a pathway in the brain that triggers the widespread death of cells after a stroke. Researchers at the University of Queensland believe it's a breakthrough that could protect stroke patients while they're being taken to hospital. Doctors often talk about a 4.5-hour window to give proper care and drugs to stroke patients. Those who live a long way from a hospital can suffer the consequences. The research team believes a drug developed from spider venom could be administered immediately by paramedics, protecting patients from further brain damage following a stroke. Professor Glenn King is the lead scientist.
The brain becomes acidic, and it turns out there's this little ion channel sitting on your neurons called acid-sensing ion channel, which senses this decrease in pH. It turns on and it sets off a cell death pathway for reasons we don't understand, and your neurons begin to die. And so what we found in the venom of the Fraser Island funnel web spider is the best known inhibitor of that channel. And if you inhibit that channel, you prevent the neurons dying. So we can't stop neurons that have already died, but we've shown that you can give this drug up to 8 hours after the stroke and still get really massive protection of the brain.
The Fraser Island funnel web spider is unique to the Australian state of Queensland. It lives in burrows beneath soil and sand. Clinical trials are some way off, but the team says that experiments with rodents have been successful. The World Health Organization says that stroke is the second leading cause of death globally and the third leading cause of disability. In Australia, it's estimated that 56,000 people suffer a new or recurrent stroke each year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, The Voice of America.
Hi, there. This is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing...